Space, time, and matter. The mysterious forces of nature. What is gravity? The symbols representing all the elements around us. Bright minds known as theoretical physicists. Everything falls to Earth with the same acceleration.
My name is Howard Burden, Executive Director of Perimeter Institute, and it's a pleasure to welcome you here for tonight's special lecture by George Johnson. It's a real privilege to have George here. There are people, I'm sure, who have been reading his books and reading his columns in the New York Times and elsewhere and are very anxious to hear him talk this evening. He's a wonderful speaker and a very erudite and wide-ranging individual. Mr. Johnson is an award-winning science writer who has authored 7 books on a wide variety of topics ranging from memory to particle physics to quantum computing, and has written articles for a large number of publications, including the Atlantic Monthly, Scientific American, Slate, Wired, and the New York Times, where he has been a regular contributor. He's the co-founder and co-director of the Santa Fe Science Writing Workshop, and is also the creator of the Santa Fe Review, an online journal. He holds an MA in journalism and public affairs from the American University in Washington, and a BA in journalism from the University of New Mexico. His most recent book, and the focus of tonight's talk, is Miss Leavitt's Stars, The Untold Story of the Woman Who Discovered How to Measure the Universe. Ladies and gentlemen, George Johnson.
It's just remarkable when you think that we have this picture in our heads of the universe, and yet when we walk out in the backyard and look up at the nighttime sky, all we see is this flat canopy with lights. And if we look at them a while, we notice that the lights move across the sky, and some of them move in a disorderly manner that we know now are planets. And it's perfectly reasonable that the ancients would have thought that the universe consisted of a dome maybe a few miles overhead with lights either hanging from it like Christmas bulbs or poked into it, and there was a big light outside which was God or somebody. You can't get that distance from looking out at the night sky. You think how far we've traveled with all of our great science programs. We've gotten as far as the moon, and then we kind of turned around and said, okay, and came back and built the space shuttle, and we became the couch potatoes of the universe. We may be seeing us sometimes. And yet we still talk about quasars that are, many billions of light years from Earth. And thinking about this one day and reading a little history, and I was just struck, and I guess I knew this, but it had never really hit home, that as recently as 75 years ago, it was a matter of debate, of scholarly debate, as to whether the Milky Way was the entire universe, and whether what we now think of as other galaxies like Andromeda, the pinwheel of Andromeda, was thought to be something that's very small and close by, and rather than something huge and roughly on the order of the size of the Milky Way. 75 years ago, people were debating this, and they didn't really know. And then it just gets you thinking, like, well, how do we know this? And how do you measure these great distances in space? And you think of, what you could do if you didn't really know very much, and you thought about the problem. You could assume that all of the stars in the sky are inherently of equal brightness, like they're all, say, 500-watt light bulbs, every single one of them. And then when one is dimmer, it's because it's farther away. And you could figure out that you can tell that this one's, 4 times as far away as this one, and use the inverse square law that, with light, diminishes by the square of the distance as you go out in the universe, because it's spreading 2 ways. And so you could do that if you made that assumption that all stars are the same brightness, but there's no reason to really think that they're all inherently putting out the same amount of power. So how could you, maybe you would come up with a theory that said the reddish stars are like 500-watt stars, and the greenish stars are a different wattage, and you could build a theory out of that. But again, based on not much but speculation. Or maybe all the stars and constellations that begin with the letter A or a certain brightness, you know, just a really weird, weird universe. That would be the designer, intelligent design universe, I guess. But so how did we figure this out? And some of you, I'm sure, a lot of you have probably read histories of astronomy, and you've heard of this woman named Henrietta Swan Leavitt, or if you haven't heard of her, you've heard of these stars called Cepheid variables that she discovered that helped us measure the universe. And what originally came out of all of this is I decided that I would do a book on how we learn to measure the universe. And this is actually the proposal that I wrote for the book. It was just kind of a short email that I sent to my editor. And my idea was that I really liked the idea of this woman named Henrietta Leavitt around the turn of the 20th century, the early 1900s, sitting at this table in Harvard Observatory in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I knew that she had examined these photographic plates of stars, and she'd come up with this relationship, which I'll explain a little later. And I thought, this is a really good image with which to start a book, having Henrietta Leavitt, and you know, she kind of looks the part, you know, with her high Victorian collar and her hair in the bun, and you know, really very pretty, I think. And sitting there, poring over this data, and you know, she was hired. Her job title was a computer, because in those days they had mechanical calculators, you know, that could add and multiply, and you'd pull these big cranks, and all these gears would go around, but to do really long, complex calculations, they would hire people, usually women, and pay them 25 cents an hour to be computers. So Henrietta was a computer. I knew that much. That usually comes across in the history books. They'll have like a little box on the facing page, usually with this picture and then a couple of paragraphs about what she did. So she's really a footnote in the history of astronomy. And I thought I'd use her just to kind of get going and then tell the rest of the story. But, you know, and started looking into what was known about her and finding that it's, you know, just frustratingly little. This is one of the canned biographies, you know, who's who in American science, who's who among women in science, who's who among this or that. And you see these little blurbs, and one thing that struck me when I read this one is it says that, you know, that she was born in Massachusetts, that her father was a minister, a congregational minister. You know, she's what we in the United States used to call good Puritan stock. She kind of looks like a pilgrim, you know. And then later she went to Oberlin College. You know, and this is the first time I'd heard this, I think, that she entered Oberlin where she flourished, although her hearing was by this time deteriorating. And I hadn't realized that she was deaf. But then I looked at another one of these canned biographies, and then this one says, you know, right there with the underlines in the middle, now we have her at Oberlin, and it says, although her hearing was seriously impaired, this handicap did not impede her in school. So, you know, I think, you know, I've established that she was deaf, you know, as early as when she was in college. But then you pull up this third canned bio, and she was enrolled in the Conservatory of Music at Oberlin. So just all this conflicting information. And then this one says, although extremely deaf, she impressed her classmates, quote, with the clarity of her mind and the sweet reasonableness of her nature. Now, you know, so now she's deaf when she's at Radcliffe. She was among the first class to graduate Radcliffe College. It says there somewhere, 1880-something. But again, I was going to be a little dubious because, well, was she deaf at Oberlin or deaf here? And how could she have been in the Conservatory of Music? And this quote was really nice. And, you know, I spent 2 years researching this book, and I'm pretty sure I read everything that exists about Leavitt or anything written about her or anything she wrote, and I never found the source of that quote. And it just makes you wonder, you know, they don't make these things up, I'm sure. But okay, now I get another one, and this one has her already out of Harvard, I mean already out of Radcliffe. She's working at Harvard College Observatory as a computer. saying that Leavitt spent the remainder of the 1890s traveling, teaching school, making measurements of stellar brightness at Harvard Observatory. And now, it's in 1900, illness leads her to go for a long stay with her family in Wisconsin, and although she lost part of her hearing, she was persuaded to return. So now she's not only not deaf until 1900, but she's only partially deaf. So I just kept running into this. There's just so little known about her. And then I corresponded with one of the someone who'd written one of these profiles, and he said, well, I'll send you, my file of information, and he sent me this story here, and it says, the really interesting thing about this story was that it's in here somewhere. She had dreamed of a career as a concert pianist, but she couldn't do this because she became deaf. So this kind of jives with her being in the Conservatory of Music at Oberlin, and yet, there's nothing on this clip, this little piece of yellowed newspaper that he Xeroxed for me that says where this article came from or what his source was on this. It turned out, with a little sleuthing, I found out that it appeared in a paper, I don't know if it's popular here, but in the United States, called the National Enquirer. So, again, I found nothing in any of my research that, would indicate that that was true. So, I'm wondering, who is this woman? I went back to the original records, and it's really rather amazing, but you can get online now through places like Ancestry.com, and there's some rivals. You can sign up and actually get images on your screen of census reports. This is from 1910, and I got the census from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I can't remember, I think I... Yeah, and I just searched for Leavitt because they have it indexed on a computer database, and then it tells you which picture to look at. And then you actually get the handwritten census report, right there from the census taker who was, there with his quill pen or whatever they used, and writing down the members of the Leavitt household and just starting to, put the story together. One thing I noticed pretty soon was there was like a Mira F. Leavitt, who is a daughter. She's like 2 years old then, and she died a year later. She had another sibling who died at birth. So, starting to get some data here, and then found out that, found her house, and, went and looked at that in Cambridge, just trying to make this person real to me. You'd think, too, if, someone like this would graduated from Radcliffe College, one of the first classes to graduate, who'd become this important person, or at least an important footnote in the history of astronomy, that you would contact Radcliffe University and they would just be so pleased that you were, looking into this and have all these interesting files and archives to show you. And they said, really nothing been further from the case. They seemed very uninterested, and all they could come up with, they sent me in an envelope, and it was just like the same Xerox canned bios that I already had. And but then Oberlin, I contacted them, and it turns out they had this questionnaire that Henrietta had filled out in her own hand after she started working at the observatory and describing some places where she'd lived. And one thing that struck me is this reference to travel in Europe, and you start to get a picture that this was someone who must have been, somewhat affluent. She went to Radcliffe College. She was able to travel in Europe, and there were several of these trips, but not really clear where she went or with whom. Then she took a job around 1903, as I mentioned, as a computer, and this is what the computers look like. This is a picture of them all sitting, and I'll show you in a minute what they're doing. They're sitting at these light tables looking at star charts, and it just, they really look the part. And it's just, in the Victorian wallpaper. So this is a room in Harvard University, and the astronomers would give them these photographic plates, these pictures of the nighttime sky, and they would measure the brightness of these stars. And these plates, I found out, were just a whole great story in themselves. They're glass photographic plates, and they were taken at this observatory in the mountains of Peru in the late 19th century. And, you know, they'd have to bring them down on the back of burros or mules, presumably, these heavy glass plates after they'd exposed them. And then they would ship them on the boat around the Cape to Boston Harbor and then offload them and bring them to Harvard Observatory. And the astronomers would give them to the computers and actually, you know, have them get to work. That's a picture of an older picture, later picture of Henrietta doing the work. And this is about this time. You wonder, it sounds like drudgery. You know, I mean, they were paid 25 cents an hour, and when Henrietta Leavitt showed that she was really, really good at this, they gave her a raise to 30 cents an hour. And using just like a quick inflation calculator online, that comes out to, you know, about $5 an hour in today's money. So, you know, it's definitely kind of mean. You can imagine trying to get people to do this kind of exacting, menial, intelligent, meticulous work now for $5 an hour. You know, it would just be, you know, you'd probably have to, you know, farm it out to shops in Asia or something. But they would hire these women, and a lot of them, I think, were like Leavitt, where they were from pretty good families, and they didn't really need to make a lot of money, but they wanted to have some respectable employment. And at some point around the time that Leavitt was working there, somebody wrote a parody called The Observatory Pinafore to, you know, the Gilbert and Sullivan comic operetta, HMS Pinafore. And just some of the lines from this kind of give you a sense of both what it was like to be a computer. This is that some of the computers and astronomers acting it out years later. But this is referring to the astronomer's job. He must open the dome and turn the wheel and watch the stars with untiring zeal. He must toil at night, though cold it be, and he should never expect a decent salary. And her boss's name was Edward Pickering, who was the head of the observatory, who's the computers and the other astronomers' boss. And he would write in his journals about, you know, sitting in the Harvard Observatory at night and taking observations with the telescope and how incredibly cold it was, you know, on those Boston winter nights. And this was, you know, right, it's just, maybe a 15-minute walk north of Harvard Square, and this was, for a while, the premier observatory in the world with the most powerful telescope. And, you know, of course, now it was before any of the Boston suburbs and electric lighting had just completely wiped out the nighttime sky in Cambridge, but they were, you know, doing real astronomy there. This is also in Observatory Pinafore, this is where the computers, and they're all, you can imagine this chorus, and they're all wearing their prim little costumes, and they say, we work from morn till night. Computing is our duty. We're faithful and polite, and our record book's a beauty. So they kind of made a joke about it, too. So it was sort of a camaraderie of people in this almost Dickensian kind of atmosphere, it seemed. But you know, I think generally respected and liking the work. This is the light frame that they used. And this is one of the glass photographic plates of something. This happens to be something called M44, which is sometimes called the Beehive Cluster. And this is like a digitization of a glass plate with these stars on it. And you can see, in addition to the ones you can immediately see, if you looked at that for a while, you'd see tens of thousands more. And, you know, if you exposed it longer, even more. And in the computers would sit at these plates, at these tables, and they'd have the plate on the right side there propped up, and the light would come into the window to illuminate it, and they would look at these things, and they would measure, they would get some information from the position of the sky that the plate had been taken in, and then they would measure the coordinates of the stars and write them down, and then they would compare them with stars of known brightness and figure out what their magnitude was, how bright they were. And this was her job. They would just give her one of these plates and, you know, say, you know, go at it. And it occurred to me that maybe, it turns out there was another computer there who was also deaf, named Annie Cannon. And it may have been an occupational advantage in a work, you know, work that required that much concentration. But early on, one of Henrietta's task that she was given, being one of the best computers. Oh, I skipped over this. This is the picture of the Harvard plate stacks. They're down in the basement of the observatory, and they have 500,000 of these glass plates all indexed in this room. And then there's a there's a story that we haven't been able to verify that the room is sort of built in a cage that sits on springs, kind of like the springs on a flatbed pickup truck, and leaf springs. And in case there's an earthquake, so that you wouldn't just destroy like 200 years of astronomical knowledge that are all in this glass, these glass plates. They're currently finally being digitized plate by plate, and it's this huge project. And that's Harvard Observatory. Levitt was asked to look at the glass plate of the Magellanic Clouds, which, you know, the Magellanic Clouds are kind of to the southern hemisphere what the Milky Way is to the northern hemisphere. And after reading about them for so many years, I finally had the chance to see them just about a year ago down in Patagonia, and just walking outside at night in the middle of the darkness and looking up and just seeing this a famous astronomer named John Herschel, I think, had described the Magellanic Clouds as looking like a couple of pieces of the Milky Way had broken off and kind of drifted into another part of the sky. And so Edward Pickering, you know, tells Henrietta Leavitt, you know, we want you to work on the Magellanic Clouds, and what we're looking for are stars that vary in brightness, variable stars. And so she's supposed to look for these. And the way you do that is you take a picture like this. This isn't actually one of the glass plates, as you can see a little color in there. Newer picture this is. But you take a glass plate that looked like the one I'd showed you before, and then they would make in the lab a negative of the same plate. So on one plate, you have the stars showing up as like black dots against a white sky, and on the other one is the usual white dots against a black sky. You'd line these up on your viewing frame very carefully. And if you did it right, if a star got bright, oh, and one of these would be taken, say, in January, and one would be taken 3 months later in March. So and one was a negative and one was a positive. So you'd line them up, and then you would see if a star, on the black plate where the stars are black, if it had grown in size, there'd be like a large white halo around it from the other plate kind of shining through the glass. And you would look for these little target patterns like that. And if you saw one, you thought, well, you know, this star maybe suddenly got brighter, which might mean it was a supernova. And they found some supernova novae that way. But then you'd take another plate from 3 months after that and hold it up to the second plate, and then maybe it went back down again. And by looking at plates from different intervals, you could find that some of these stars were just kind of pulsing, you know, brighter, dimmer, over periods that ranged from several days to several weeks. You could just imagine doing that with these glass plates, with your mirror, with the light coming in the window, and looking for these things, and then not only identifying the fact that they are pulsating like this in brightness, but to have to map exactly where they are in the sky. So she spent many years basically doing this, and she really did it all of her life. She never married. She just kept working at the observatory, and at some point her father died and her mother moved to Cambridge, and they moved in together at this apartment building here. And she just kept working on her stars, but the reason that we know her name, and she was just not one more of the people who were doing this, is that she noticed this relationship and this kind of pattern that jumped out of her. One day she was writing down the list of these variables that she'd noticed in the small Magellanic Cloud. There's a large Magellanic Cloud and a small one. And she wrote them down, and she recorded their brightness and magnitude, you know, that it went from so many magnitude to this, back to this again, and what the rhythm is. And she was looking at it, and she thought, huh, this is funny. It looks like the slower the rhythm of the star, the slower its pulse, the brighter it is on the brighter its top brightness is when it peaks out. She looked at a few more, and it was the same thing. And she was just studying about 13, and she thought, you know, and she put them on a graph with logarithmic paper and noticed a straight logarithmic scale, noticed a straight line. So basically, depending on how fast or how slowly the star changed brightness, you could guess what its final brightness was. And all these stars she was looking at were in the same formation, the Magellanic Cloud, so you could roughly argue that they're all the same distance from Earth. So what she had found was a way to tell how bright one of these stars is, you know, many, many light years across the universe. And it would be like in my original analogy with the light bulbs, or, you know, if all stars are 500-watt light bulbs, it would be as though when stars were made that they were designed somehow, or the laws were wired into the universe so that a 500-watt star would always blink on and off at a rhythm of a certain rhythm, and that a 200-watt star, a dimmer star, would blink a little faster, and then it was correlated. So anytime you found one of these stars, you could see how fast it blinked, and you would know how bright it was, and therefore you could figure out how far away it was. This is as far as she brought out her work. It came out in a paper, and it was cited quite a bit, and then Edward Pickering kind of shoveled her off to a different job, which was not involving variable stars, so she never really got to work out the details of the theory. And then there, just before about 1920, Harlow Shapley, who some of you may know, was one of the great astronomers of the 20th century, and Pickering had died, and Shapley came to Harvard Observatory to take over the observatory and be the boss. And I found some correspondence where Shapley had actually, you know, written exchange letters with Henrietta Leavitt asking her about these variables, because he had this plan that he was going to use them to map the size of the Milky Way galaxy, and he was just starting to do that. And he went on to show that the Milky Way was vastly bigger than we think it is by finding Cepheids in the Milky Way, and using work from another astronomer who had shown how to calibrate your scale. And because, you know, basically what Henrietta Leavitt had found, she found these variable stars in the Magellanic Cloud. So if you found one in another part of the universe that was blinking at the same rhythm as one in the Magellanic Cloud, you could assume that its inherent brightness was such and such, and then you could use the inverse square law to see how far away it was. But, you know, the problem is we didn't know how far the Magellanic Clouds were from Earth. So it was like you could say, well, you know, this formation here is like 2 Magellanic Clouds from Earth, and this one is 3.5 Magellanic Clouds. So unless you wanted the Magellanic Clouds to be your unit, you had to measure the distance of the Magellanic Cloud themselves. And this was later, they actually used Cepheids to do that by finding some Cepheid variables that were close enough inside the Milky Way that you could use, not exactly parallax, but, you know, where you look at something from two different angles and see how it shifts in the sky, and use simple trigonometry to measure the distance. It was a little more complex than that. It's what they call statistical parallax that won't get into. But basically, they were able to anchor the distance of a few of these, and once they had a few, any Cepheid in the sky would tell you how far away it was by how quickly it blinked. So Shapley took Miss Leavitt's stars, mapped out the Milky Way, and concluded that the Milky Way was in fact so big that surely it must be the entire universe. I mean, you know, how could there be anything else? And that Andromeda was just this little pinwheel that was very close by. And in fact, one astronomer named Adrian von Manen had studied Andromeda again, you know, like year to year to year, and he thought he was able to measure the speed at which it was rotating, which of course from Earth is hardly at all. And from this he concluded that unless Andromeda is really, really close to Earth, it would have to be spinning so quickly that it would violate it would be going faster than light, which you may learn later this month is okay. But And this was generally considered by Shapley and others to be, you know, pretty good proof that these things were not other galaxies, that they were just little things close by. So Shapley used Leavitt stars to conclude this, and in 1925, there was a big debate, they still call it the Great Debate in astronomy, between Shapley and another astronomer named Heber Curtis. And Curtis was arguing that, the Milky Way is much smaller than you think it is, and Andromeda is a galaxy, that there's like any number of galaxies, that these are all like what Kant called island universes. And they had this big debate on the floor of the National Academy of Sciences in Washington, and it's fun to read their correspondence afterwards, because both of them left the debate bragging to their wives how they'd won. And no one still knew if who had won. Probably you know the story a little later that Edward Hubble then was studying Andromeda, the American astronomer down at Mount Wilson, and looking at photographic plates, and found a Cepheid variable in Andromeda. And there were like two, he would take two plates taken a certain amount of time apart and put them in this device called a blink comparometer. And you would look through, these eyepieces, and then by flipping a little lever back and forth, the system of mirrors would show you one and then the other. So if anything changed in the photographs of these two same pieces of the night sky, it would jump out at you, and then he saw something just go like that, and he thought he'd found a supernova, and then he looked at another one 3 months later, and it went back down again. So it was like blinking like a traffic light, and he knew about Henrietta Leavitt stars, and he thought, aha, a Cepheid, and he used that and measured and showed by his calculations Andromeda had to be 1 million light years from Earth, in which case, by its very size in the sky, you would calculate that it was another huge galaxy and not just a little thing. Now, Henrietta Leavitt didn't live to see any of that. She was 1921, she fell ill, and I'd never been able to find anything that really told me, you know, what had happened, how she died. I just knew she died young, you know, just living alone with her mother. And found some journals at the Harvard archives that were kept by Annie Cannon, the other computer who later became a full-fledged astronomer, who was also partially deaf. And it's just very, very moving. I thought I'd read it to you. And this is Annie Cannon writing. It says, "Took flowers to Miss Leavitt, who is very ill," Cannon wrote in her diary for November 6, 1921. "It was a dreary month. By Thanksgiving, Cambridge was besieged by the worst ice storm in memory. Trees and electric poles were breaking under the clinging sleet. The observatory lights went out." Cannon's diary describes what came next. "December 6th, went to see poor Henrietta Leavitt, dying with a malignant stomach trouble. So thin and changed, very, very sad. December 8th, clear and cold. Harlow Shapley dropped by to pay his respects." Quote, Mrs. Shapley, "One of the few decent things I've done was to call on her deathbed," he later said. "It made life so much different," friends said, "that the director came to see her." Maybe so. December 12th, rainy day, pouring at night. Henrietta passed away at 10:30 p.m. December 13th, Mr. Leavitt, Henrietta's brother, called early in the morning. Snowy, sloppy, dark day. December 14th, Wednesday, Henrietta's funeral at First Congregational Church, 2 p.m., coffin covered with flowers. I found that you could get someone's last will and testament really easily in Massachusetts, and they have such good records that they went back this far, and I sent off and got it. And you know, we'd said, it's concluded before that she must have been, you know, fairly well off, because she has all these references to traveling in Europe and getting a good education. And her will and last will and testament was written. She wrote it on her deathbed. It's a little too faded to read up here, but she basically wrote it out in hand while her mother and one of her friends and a relative sat side by side, and then later the executors of her estate listed her schedule of personal property. You know, it's things like a table, bookcase and books, rug, bureau, a couple of bonds. The whole thing came to $314.91. It was her whole estate. She left it to her mother. Someone who reviewed my book just kind of not, you know, made fun of me for, you know, putting in this detail, like, you know, showing her entire list of possessions, like they thought it was, you know, kind of silly. But I thought that was rather moving. It was Toronto paper, actually, I think. And 4 months after the funeral, oh, and this is Leavitt's grave that I, you know, found in the Cambridge Cemetery, and you know, you can see her other siblings who died young, and they're buried right next to William Henry James and Alice James, and you know, I just happened to turn around and see that. That was really, really rather amazing coincidence. 4 months after the funeral, Annie Cannon found herself on a steamer bound for Peru. This again is the other computer. For a tour of the Andes and a visit to the observatory where all these plates had been taken of the night sky that she and Leavitt had done this work on. One evening, after immersing herself in the clear southern skies, Cannon made a note in her diary. The Magellanic cloud, great, so bright, it always makes me think of poor Henrietta, how she loved the stars. There are the Magellanic clouds again. I got more census records from the last census when she would have been alive was 1920, and this is the one that found her in this, living in this kind of apartment boarding house with her mother on Linnaean Street, which those of you who know Cambridge know it's right near Observatory Hill and intersects with Garden Street, so she could walk to work. And they ask her, you know, they ask people what their jobs were. And you know, all this time she had been, you know, described as an assistant at the observatory or a computer at the observatory. Never, you know, was anything, you know, beyond that. And I just thought it was rather nice that when she was asked her by the census taker what her occupation was, she said astronomer. So I'm going to read a few more words and then close from toward the end of the book, which just kind of makes a nice denouement, I think. 4 years after Henrietta Swan Leavitt's death, her presence lived on, not just in her discovery about Cepheid variables, but in a ghost story that circulated around Observatory Hill. Cecilia Payne, the young Harvard astronomer and later a department chairman, who had inherited Henrietta's old desk, was amused to hear rumors that Miss Leavitt's lamp was still seen to be burning in the night, that her spirit still haunted the plate stacks. More likely, she concluded, someone had seen Payne herself as she burned the midnight oil, sometimes working on theories about variable stars. There's something almost ghost-like in the scant traces Leavitt left in the public record. It's like biographical ectoplasm to be shaped according to one's need. After years of so little recognition, there's followed an almost reflexive rush to mythologize her. A planetarium has been named after, albeit a virtual one, residing only on the World Wide Web. While Harlow Shapley had an entire cluster of galaxies named in his honor, Leavitt and Annie Cannon got a crater on the moon. In brief hagiographies scattered across the web, the same few scraps of data about Leavitt's life, often the same sentences, are repeated again and again, all traceable to a few stable sources. She's been turned into a standard bearer by people less interested in her astronomy than in the fact that she was a woman and deaf. Among the factoids that ricochet through the infosphere is that she was nominated for a Nobel Prize. What really happened is that in 1925, an elderly Swedish mathematician, Gustav Mittag Leffler, heard something about Leavitt's work from a colleague and was impressed enough to write her a letter. He didn't know that she was already dead. "Honored Miss Leavitt," he began, "what my friend and colleague Professor von Zippel of Uppsala has told me about your admirable discovery of the empirical law touching the connection between magnitude and period length for the S. Cepheid variables in Little Magellan's cloud has impressed me so deeply that I feel seriously inclined to nominate you to the Nobel Prize in Physics. 1926. Although I must confess that my knowledge of the matter is as yet rather complete. He was a mathematician and his expertise was analytical function theory. He asked her for more information and vowed to handle the matter, quote, with the greatest discretion in the way that seems to me most likely to further my plan. He also promised to send for her perusal a treatise he had written on Sonia Kowalewski, the stunning young Russian mathematician, and her correspondence with Carl Weierstrass, her older mentor who had furthered her career. Maybe Mittag Leffler was hoping Henrietta would become his Sonia. When the letter arrived at the observatory, it was forwarded to the director, Harlow Shapley. It's hard to quite know what to make of his reply. He wrote back to Mittag Leffler, "Miss Leavitt's work on the variable stars and the Magellanic clouds, which led to the discovery of the relation between the period and apparent magnitude, has afforded a very powerful tool in measuring great stellar distances." So he's saying led to the discovery of the relationship, as you know, her phrasing suggests that was just not as important as she really was, the human computer, the diligent manipulator of data. The next sentence continues in this vein, faint praise weighed with subtle condescension, and then Shapley closes. "To me personally, the discovery has also been of the highest service, for it was my privilege to interpret the observation by Miss Leavitt, place it on a basis of absolute brightness, and extending it to the variables of the globular clusters, use it in my measures of the Milky Way. It's clear whom Shapley would like to nominate for the prize." It's hard to say. You know, people ask, could she have become an astronomer? Certainly she could have. And at that time, it was not something that women were often encouraged to do. This woman, Cecilia Payne, who went on to take over Leavitt's desk, later became a very, very eminent astronomer and became the chairman of the astronomy department at Harvard. And she'd never met Leavitt, but she later thought that, she had really, if he had been given a chance to just kind of, once she discovered these variables, to encourage to work out the implications herself, she realized what she had. She mentioned in one of her papers that this clearly offers the possibility of measuring these great distances, and then was kind of shunted off to something else. But nothing I ever found that she wrote. There was a diary, but it was just kind of mostly a scientific diary. Whatever lead you to know if she was, content and just happy to be a small part in something grander called science. And I just got the impression that, unlike maybe Shapley or Edward Hubble, that she didn't really care if she got credit for the discovery or who made the discovery. That she was just, proud to be a part of this. And so then in the end, had enough to kind of give a trajectory through her life and then hang the story on how we measure the universe and how it is that we can talk about things billions of light years away and a universe 25, 26 billion light years across. And it all comes down to this measuring scale that just hinges on the very bottom of Henrietta's stars. Thank you very much. Are there any other American women who are mathematicians or physicists who also, played a small role like this and, didn't get their complete due? It's not something I didn't really get into writing this book because I wanted to vindicate Henrietta Leavitt or anything. I was just kind of fascinated by her story. But I know once I started talking to people at Harvard Observatory, the Cecilia Payne, for example, was apparently quite unhappy there and felt that she hadn't, even though she did really excel, that she wasn't fully appreciated. And there's, it depends on the science too. In astronomy, you hear that more. I'm sure, anyone in superstring theory or almost any kind of physics, you sometimes just hear, women in these subjects speaking rather bitterly, but then in other sciences like biology, not at all. So I really don't know, but she to me was the, you know, the really interesting one that needed to be brought forth.
Has your book had any effect on people at Harvard or people at Radcliffe after your book came out? Did they make any more efforts to commemorate Henrietta at all? Has there been any?
Yeah, nothing that I've heard yet. Yeah, it was kind of ironic that it came out, you know, about the same time as the when Larry Summers, the president of Harvard, was speculating that maybe women had an inherent disability to do mathematics, and yet here, the observatory at his very college was hiring women, particularly because they were good at this in the 1900s. But the most important thing is just that you can correlate how fast they're pulsing with what their inherent brightness is, and therefore use them as what they call standard candles. So if you find one of the same kind of star another place in the universe, then you will know that. You'll know how far away it is, at least compared to the other star. But there's also pulsars, and there's different kinds of variable stars. Like there's what's called the Mira variables and the Lyra variables. There's just a whole slew of these things. None of them are considered to have as precise a lockstep correlation between their periodicity and their brightness as the Cepheids do. So everything in all of them indeed are really correlated using the Cepheids as a reference standard. Is that what you meant, or do you want to know why they do this, why they blink? Oh, well, they all change in brightness, but they don't all. What these are is they're stars, they're very old stars that have kind of getting near the end of their life, and what keeps the stars from collapsing under their own gravity is the fusion energy furnace in the middle, and the heat is causing them to expand outward. At the same time, the gravity's containing them. And you can get into a cycle. Some stars at a certain point of their life get to where they start contracting. But when you contract, you're concentrating all this this fusionable material in the middle of the star, so the fusion reaction will become more intense, produce more heat, it will come out, then it will cool, then it will collapse. So, it's a little more complicated than that. It involves some things about the transparency of the gases and things, but basically that's what's happening. And it does happen with other stars, but there's all kinds of things that can happen to stars when they get old, apparently. They can, if they just keep collapsing, they get so small and intense, they might explode and become a supernova.
There's a question right here in the front.
How much credit did the people who worked on her work get?
Well, the person who really calibrated her scale that was a huge, hugely important step. Hertzsprung was Ingenieur Hertzsprung. He's like one of the giants of astronomy. There's something called the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram that everyone learns in astronomy class. And then Shapley was, he was kind of like the Carl Sagan of his days in some ways. He was a real public figure, quoted in the newspapers all the time about the future of science. But it's also true that a lot of the astronomers that were down hovering in the cold in the mountains in Arequipa, Peru, taking the actual photographic plates didn't get a whole lot of credit either. So, it's really the theorists who made something of the data. So maybe that's fair.
You make an interesting comment right at the end when you speculated that despite the paucity of information, Henrietta perhaps was one of these people who is not motivated so much by glory, but motivated to contribute towards knowledge.
It's nice to think that.
And I know that you've done quite a bit of other biographical studies of scientists and the like. How common would you say that is among
the self-effacement?
The self-effacement. Those who aren't self-effacement might be too strong, but those who aren't necessarily motivated before or after the fact for any sense of glory,
but
just to contribute to the enterprise and doing science for science's sake. Is that tremendously rare in your view, or is that?
To me, it seems just vanishingly rare, but partially. But there is a selection effect here, because as a journalist, of course, I'm going after the people who I find out about are good at making themselves known often. But also, the reason they become known is because they've done something great and deserve the attention. So there's a certain selection effect there. But there's just the contrast there. One of the books I wrote before this was a biography of a physicist named Murray Gell-Mann, who's just like the complete opposite of, I mean, he's one of the most important particle physicists in the 20th century physics, but everyone gets together, as we were doing over lunch today at Perimeter, and exchanges their Murray Gell-Mann stories. And when I first met Murray in Santa Fe, I happened to just randomly sit down at the same table with him at a scientific conference that the Santa Fe Institute was sponsoring. This was before I had any thought of writing his biography, and I introduced myself. And back then, I was still on staff at the New York Times, and he said, "Oh, so the New York Times, huh?" And then he kind of launched into this diatribe about science writers, and it reached its climax with him talking about a guy named William Lawrence, who got the Pulitzer Prize for breaking the story of the Manhattan Project after World War II. But Murray described him as a man of impenetrable stupidity, unmatched even by science writers today.
Well, there's something to be said for coming out on top, I suppose. There's a question back there.
Yes. Did Henrietta get to co-author the paper? Which she just mentioned in the acknowledgments. And how many authors were there on the paper?
Yeah, there were two papers, and the common thing then was, if there was, the computers hardly ever found anything that would, that was that, I mean, nothing ever that remarkable, but usually what it was is one of the astronomers would write a paper, and then he would say that, Miss Leavitt or Miss Cannon or Miss so-and-so, found, and they would just get this glancing mention. And in the first report of this possible relationship, it was actually under the byline of Edward Pickering, and it said, "Miss Henrietta Leavitt has noticed." But he was just doing a report. And I know some people I talked to have kind of tried to put a nefarious spin on that, but I think that was just the formality of how it was done. Her next paper was published in the Annals of the Harvard Observatory under her own name, the most important of the papers. So she was very much published as an astronomer. And after this, before she died of cancer, she was often getting sick and having to go to convalesce back with her parents. And often Pickering and some of the other astronomers would bring her papers to the Astronomical Society conferences and deliver the papers for her. So by that time, they were, it's ambiguous, her case and how she was treated. But.
Well, at this point, I'd like to thank you very much again for a very, very stimulating and informative talk. Thank you very much, Mr. Brown.
Thank you. Thank you.